You're listening to KORC LPFM 105.9 Corvallis.
The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
Hello, Civics Cafe listeners. This is Wendy Byrne bringing you this week's serving of Local Civics. Let's start things off with an update on a topic I initially covered towards the end of the show 2 weeks ago regarding something called the Serial Meetings Rule. During that show, I stated that in the opening minutes of the City Council work session on March 31st, the mayor said that one of the city councilors had violated the Serial Meetings Rule. A serial meeting refers to a series of communications, either direct or indirect, such as via email, where a majority of the city council collectively discusses, deliberates, or takes action on an item within their jurisdiction without a formal meeting taking place. It is worth noting that the State of Oregon's public meetings law prohibits serial meetings. I'd like to clarify here, for the record, that the mayor of Corvallis did not, in fact, say that anyone had violated the serial meetings rule. He did open the meeting with this statement, quote, "Staff will be providing additional guidance regarding proper email communications and best practices to avoid serial meetings," end quote. This statement coming from the mayor led me to believe that a violation had occurred. After more research and feedback from members of the city council, my understanding is that no such violation occurred. What did happen is that one or two email threads were started by members of the city council, which included all of the council members, which flirts with the inadvertent creation of a serial meeting. Any listener interested in learning more about this rule can contact me at wendy@korcfm.com, and I will send you a link to the 2.5-hour-long public meetings law training from the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, which is the same training that was given to our city council members. Okay, what tasty items are on the menu of the cafe for today? Speaking of tasty, are you all aware that this weekend marked the opening of the farmers market in downtown Corvallis? Yes. Since mid-January, we have been able to purchase fresh local food items at the Winter Saturday Market at the Benton County Fairgrounds. But as of this week, we can now enjoy the best of what our local farms have to offer twice a week on Wednesdays and Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on First Street in Corvallis. From April until the week before Thanksgiving, we can enjoy the bounty of our part of the Willamette Valley at this open-air market. Last week, on April 14th, there was a meeting of the Economic Development Coalition. The Economic Development Coalition, formerly known as the Economic Development Advisory Board, advises City Council and the Benton County Commissioners in all matters pertaining to economic development, ensuring that economic development is a civic priority. The Economic Development Coalition consists of 9 voting members. As this is a coalition that serves both the city and the county, 6 members are appointed by the Mayor of Corvallis and 3 are appointed by the Benton County Commissioners. The point of contact for the Economic Development Coalition is Christopher Jacobs, who is the Economic Development Manager of the Economic Development Office. The coalition meets as needed, and meetings are open to the public to attend in person or virtually. Additionally, all meetings are recorded and can be accessed via the city's archives or on Vimeo at vimeo.com/cityofcorvallis. At their meeting on the 14th, they reviewed the Economic Development Office's third quarter report that Manager Jacobs will be presenting to the City Council on April 21st. Watching the discussion of this report, one item stood out to me when they were reviewing the threats to local economic development. The City of Corvallis has a very high percentage of government-related employees. In fact, according to statistics from the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, more than 37% of Corvallis area employees work in a government-related job. This makes our workforce highly vulnerable to changes in federal policies. Let that sink in for a minute. On a more positive note, Manager Jacobs' report had good things to say about the desirability of our downtown as an economic hub for Corvallis. For more information about the report, watch the City Council meeting on April 21st or find the report in the city's archives at corvallisoregon.gov. It was nice to hear Manager Jacobs say positive things about our downtown, because despite having room to improve and being the likely center of attention for focused development in the near future, downtown has lots to offer. Just yesterday, I enjoyed the 1 mile walk from my house to downtown, and in the course of less than 2 hours, I visited a lovely tea shop, the post office, 2 bookstores, had a fabulous ice cream, and walked home. Ah, Corvallis in the springtime. If you haven't had the ice cream on First Street at Sugar J's, you do not know what you're missing. On Wednesday, April 16th, the Planning Commission had a meeting. The bulk of their 90 minutes was spent discussing the South Corvallis Area Plan. Area plans supplement the city's comprehensive plan by providing a focused approach to planning and development within a geographic context that goes beyond the neighborhood level. The city has three adopted area plans. These are the North Corvallis Area Plan, the South Corvallis Area Refinement, and the West Corvallis North Philomath Area Plan. Each plan is due for an update, and the process has started with South Corvallis first. Over the past few years, community members have been invited to participate in planning the future of South Corvallis. Earlier this year, city planners presented their first draft of the plan, called Scenario 1, to the City Council, and also had an open house to review the plan with the community. Based on feedback from the community, a Scenario 2 has been developed. At the Planning Commission meeting this week, both scenarios were reviewed, and the commissioners were asked to discuss the pros and cons of the two scenarios and decide which one to recommend the City Council adopt. Scenario 2 was developed in response to robust opposition from South Corvallis residents to zoning density changes along Crystal Lake Drive in Scenario 1. Members of the Planning Commission had a thoughtful discussion about the importance of increasing density as Corvallis grows. And they also discussed that most neighborhoods will be understandably resistant to change, but if one area is allowed to resist changes, is that fair? If the South Corvallis residents can alter the plan with their opposition, how do we then say no to the residents of other areas of town when it is time to alter their plans for their neighborhoods? In Corvallis, residents pay more of their income for housing than in any other part of the state, and saying no to residential density is not a way to solve that problem. In the end, the Planning Commission voted unanimously to recommend that the City Council adopt a hybrid of Scenarios 1 and 2, which includes higher density zoning in the area of Crystal Lake Drive. The City Council will discuss this during their work session on April 24th, and at some point in the future, the Council will also have the final say on which version of the area plan to adopt. While my heart leans toward the lower density on Crystal Lake Drive, the members of the Planning Commission made good arguments as to why I am likely wrong. If you want to hear the debate for yourself, you can watch the video from this meeting via the City Archives or on vimeo.com/City of Corvallis. What's coming up next week? Several things. On Monday the 21st, the City Council will have their second business meeting of April at the downtown fire station. Their agenda is full. They will hold a public hearing on an annexation request for property on 53rd Street, south of Country Club Drive, followed by a presentation from the Economic Development Office. They will hear community comments, then move on to several items regarding task force creation and dissolution. As the work of the Downtown Parking Task Force reached its conclusion, it is time for a formal order to disband that task force. As we discussed last week here on Civics Cafe, the mayor is going to announce the formal creation of two new task forces, the Downtown Vitality Strategy Task Force and the Charter Review Task Force. For more details on the agenda for this meeting, please see the links on the city calendar, which is located in the center of the city's webpage at corvallisoregon.gov. Also, next week, on April 22nd, there will be a meeting of the Corvallis Climate Action Advisory Board at 4:30 p.m. in the Madison Avenue Meeting Room. On April 23rd, the Corvallis Forest Operational Advisory Committee will have a meeting starting at 5 p.m. in the Madison Avenue Meeting Room. On April 24th, the City Council will hold their second work session of April, starting at 4 p.m. in the Madison Avenue Meeting Room. At this work session, the Council will hear updates about the Wastewater Master Plan and the South Corvallis Area Plan. Telling you about the Mayor's plans to announce two new task forces brings to mind that the City is looking for community members to apply to be part of these efforts. The City relies on members of the community to volunteer for boards, commissions, task forces, and more, so that the function of the City reflects input from the community. Recruitment for openings of the various boards and commissions begins in April and closes towards the end of May. Appointments are made in June, and terms of service mostly begin in July. I've counted the current and anticipated vacancies, and they are 36. The Budget Commission will have three positions open. The Urban Renewal Agency Budget Commission will have one position open. The Historic Resources Commission has three vacancies. The Planning Commission has three vacancies. The Climate Action Advisory Board will have four vacancies. The Community Police Review Policy Advisory Board has three vacancies. The Economic Development Coalition has two vacancies. The Enterprise Zone Committee has one position open. The Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Board anticipates having 5 positions to fill. The Library Advisory Board has 1 open position. The Corvallis Forest Operational Advisory Committee has 2 vacancies. The Housing Operational Advisory Committee has 3 positions open. The Multimodal Operational Advisory Committee has 3 vacancies. And the Parks and Recreation Operational Advisory Committee has 2 positions open. If you are interested in volunteering to help make Corvallis the city where you want to live, please visit the city website to read more about the vacancies and how to apply. If you are disenchanted with the way national politics are going, focus on local and get involved. Thanks for tuning in to the Civics Cafe this week. If you have any comments or questions about the material I've shared, send me an email at wendy@korcfm.com. If you have feedback for KORC's news, music, and civics, you can email us at news@korcfm.com. I hope you enjoy the rest of KORC's News, Music, and Civics Hour. Until next time, this is Wendy Byrne.
The annual Corvallis Spring Garden Festival will be held this year on Sunday, May 4th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Art Center Plaza and Madison Avenue between 7th and 8th Streets next to Central Park. This springtime event is free and open to the public, with activities for many age levels. The festival will feature vendors with a variety of items for sale, including annuals, perennials, food, specialty plants, garden art, seeds, and more. The event will also feature live performances by local musicians. The 2025 Spring Garden Festival is sponsored by the Corvallis Sustainability Coalition, Corvallis Parks and Recreation Department, Corvallis Albany Farmers Market, and the Arts Center. That's Sunday, May 4th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the edge of Central Park.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. The following story was published in the Corvallis Gazette Times on April 17, 2025, and was authored by Hans Boyle. The headline reads, OSU international student sues Trump administration over canceled visa. One of the 13 international students at Oregon State University who saw their visas revoked earlier this month has filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration. The lawsuit comes as the administration has targeted international students at colleges nationwide with little notice or explanation, including at other Oregon universities. Aragon Ortega Gonzalez, an international OSU PhD student living in Corvallis, filed the lawsuit in the U.S. District Court on Wednesday, April 16th. He's seeking to restore his F-1 student visa status and is represented by ACLU of Oregon, Innovation Law Lab, and Nelson Smith LLP, a Portland-based immigration law firm. Ortega Gonzalez is a 32-year-old Mexican citizen and a wildlife and conservation scientist. He was approved for a student visa in 2021 and completed his master's degree in Texas in 2024, according to the lawsuit. He was accepted into a PhD program at OSU and began his studies last summer at the College of Agricultural Sciences, working as a research assistant. He's expecting to complete the program in 2029, but according to the lawsuit, OSU informed Ortega Gonzalez in an April 8th email that the U.S. government terminated his record in the database that tracks international students' visa compliance. The U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, according to the lawsuit, terminated his record on April 4th, providing only this explanation, quote, individual identified in criminal records check and or has had their visa revoked, unquote. According to the lawsuit, Ortega Gonzalez has never been convicted of a crime and has been in compliance with the terms of his student visa. In addition, checks with the online Oregon Criminal Database and other public databases indicated he has no run-ins with the law here or in Texas. Still, Ortega Gonzalez has been notified due to the termination he is expected to depart the United States immediately, according to a news release from the ACLU of Oregon. International students nationwide, including at Harvard and UCLA, have seen their visas suddenly revoked, prompting student lawsuits and leaving college officials grappling to respond. According to the lawsuit filed this week, as of Wednesday, more than 1,400 terminations have happened at nearly 100 colleges and universities, including in Oregon. These terminations have upended the lives of students lawfully contributing to the innovation and prosperity of Oregon through their academic pursuits, the lawsuit said. Some international students who have seen visas revoked had ties to pro-Palestinian protests that rocked campuses last year. Oregon universities saw such demonstration, including OSU, where students created an encampment on the Memorial Union Quad last May. University spokesperson Rob Odom told Mid Valley Media earlier this week he couldn't commit further on questions related to the details and status of the 13 international students out of privacy concerns. But prompted by the news, student groups at OSU, including those behind the encampment demonstration last spring, organized an education, not deportation rally on Wednesday. Hundreds gathered for the march, which slowly weaved through campus. Students, many wearing masks and some waving Palestinian flags and picket signs, shouted chants like "Stop the deportations" and "Free Mahmoud, Free Palestine." The latter is a reference to Columbia University graduate student and activist Mahmoud Khalil, who was detained by federal immigration officials early this spring and who participated in pro-Palestinian protests. NBC reported last week that a Department of Homeland Security task force is scouring the social media posts of 1.5 million international students for potential grounds to revoke their visas. That was a story published in the Corvallis Gazette Times on April 17, 2025, and authored by Hans Boyle. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
The Corvallis Sustainability Coalition's quarterly gathering is Monday, April 28th at the Benton County Public Library on Monroe from noon to 1:30 p.m. The event will feature presentations by Rachel Hoffman of the Benton County Historical Society, Brian Daniels of Greenhouse Coffee and Plants, Julie Williams of the Coalition's Energy Action Team, and Nancy Louise Clayton of Volunteer Interfaith Caregivers. The public is invited to participate in dialogue with other attendees who are helping to create a sustainable community and to network with representatives of the Sustainability Coalition's partner organizations who are working on environmental, social, and economic components of sustainability. Corvallis Sustainability Coalition's quarterly gathering is Monday, April 28th at the Benton County Public Library on Monroe from noon to 1:30 p.m. There's more information at sustainablecorvallis.org.
As we consider the topic of journalism in a post-truth era, it's not uncommon for us to look for those 10-second soundbites or quotes from our favorite political pundit, which succinctly sums up our thoughts on the matter.
How can we debate feminism if we can't agree what a woman is?
These attacks on U.S. power plants perpetrated by the government of Russia.
Kamala Harris shouldn't have a job. She has no skills.
Or maybe a 140-character tweet that clearly articulates our understanding of the way things are, but in a generally binary or black and white way. We may find ourselves repeating the meme of the day in a way that sounds newsy, although it's really just a catchy headline for a much more nuanced conversation that we'll never have.
And today, Donald Trump signed an executive order to dismantle the Department of Education. I know it sounds like a joke, but it's not.
So rather than being a conversation starter, our quote-unquote news that we're ingesting is doing just the opposite. It certainly does not encourage critical thinking. As I ease my way back into journalism after nearly 20 years in event videography and commercial production, the reasons I gave up on it are more evident than ever. I attended the April 5th hands-off protest at the courthouse with a very different homemade sign from everyone else's. Mine called attention to the fact that 90% of all TV and film programming is owned by six corporate conglomerates. All names you've heard of, but occasionally being rebranded, like how Viacom became Paramount Global, or when they're being bought and sold off piecemeal, like when News Corp split their assets among Disney and the Fox Corporation in 2022. 40% of all affiliate stations are operated by Sinclair Broadcasting Group, which has editorial control over local news programming. The following audio sample is from a compilation video of a Sinclair Broadcast Group editorial statement that was broadcast across all these stations in America. These were compiled by sports news company Deadspin in 2018. While the warning message is accurate, the final line just smacks of irony.
Hi, I'm Fox San Antonio's Jessica Headley.
And I'm Ryan Wolf.
Our greatest responsibility is to serve our Treasure Valley communities.
The El Paso, Las Cruces communities.
The lines are delivered one at a time at first.
We are extremely proud of the quality, balanced journalism that CBS 4 News
then
produces.
Nine at a time.
But we are concerned about trouble and trying to be responsible. One-sided news stories plaguing our country.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and
false news
has become all too common on social media.
The screen fills up with 30 different broadcasts at this point.
Unfortunately, some members of the media use their platforms to push their own personal bias and agenda to control exactly what people think. And this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
And you get the idea. On top of that, 50% of all newspapers are owned by seven corporations. And again, we rely so heavily on social media these days that it's important to recognize YouTube, X, TikTok, and Meta as prominent filters of our daily drip content as well. While these are not traditional news platforms, they cater to those looking for easy entertainment and outrage. As you may recall, Facebook rolled back their fact-checking in January. This was the statement from Mark Zuckerberg.
We've reached a point where it's just too many mistakes and too much censorship. The recent elections also feel like a cultural tipping point towards once again prioritizing speech. So we're going to get back to our roots and focus on reducing mistakes, simplifying our policies, and restoring free expression on our platforms.
My sign was not indicative of the larger theme of the hands-off protest, but a conversation starter for organizations who hope to gain traction within their respective movements. My feeling is that, due in large part to the way we communicate the news of the day, what gets filtered to them versus us, however you draw that distinction, residents of Corvallis and liberals in general are getting further and further from being able to connect with their conservative counterparts. I'm not outright denouncing this trend, by the way. When you feel that rights are being unfairly stripped from marginalized citizens, Karl Popper's paradox of tolerance comes into play, which, if you're not familiar, the sentiment is that to maintain a tolerant society, one must be intolerant of intolerance. It's a mouthful, and as the name implies, a paradox. There are lots of bad faith arguments started online based on some straw man or other logical fallacy, and when reason fails to convert the zealous, we get reactionary. But it's too convenient to dismiss folks who seem to be okay with a government trending towards fascism as crazies or Nazis just to avoid confrontation. So, in an effort to bridge the communication gap, I approached organization representatives at their various progressive booths at the rally with the goal of finding out how I could best communicate their efforts to my conservative fellow Americans.
Hi, I'm Drew Bybee. I'm with Corvallis Palestine Solidarity Group in Corvallis, Oregon.
What are you doing to spread the message to the folks that we aren't reaching currently?
It's a great question, and it's sad that we have to ask it and strategize so much to accomplish it, because our media has failed us in terms of providing accurate sampling of the reality on the ground in so many of these issues that are being covered here, from trans rights to Palestine to women's rights.
Drew is a big proponent of word-of-mouth activism.
We've gotten so much feedback from people that are like, we heard one thing you said and then it spread through our whole church or it spread through our whole union or whatever. Like, we need to keep, just speak it. When people ask you how you're doing, it's like, oh, I'm grieving for Palestine, or I'm grieving for our education system, I'm grieving for the environment. And I just don't think anyone should be like comfortable right now during a genocide.
We went on to talk about some of the atrocities that led Drew to use the word genocide. But of course, the conflict in Gaza merits its own news story. I just want to acknowledge, it's not my intent to downplay or disregard what Jewish Americans are going through. My limited understanding of Zionism and the history of Israel as a nation may lead me to some biases common to many anti-Semitic groups. My sense is that Netanyahu does not speak for the people of Israel any more than Trump does for Americans, and yet we're judged by our leadership. It's also not my intent to advocate for political violence or justify the actions of religious extremists in Hamas. But it's important to understand how much U.S.-funded military might is being wielded against a non-recognized nation with no military. Why? Just like media consolidation in this country has reduced the voice of independent journalism critical of the corporate class, so too have lobbying groups like AIPAC had a significant role in buying off our senators to support arms to Israel. So this speaks again in contrast to the mainstream narrative.
It's so important to get your news sources from legitimate people on the ground. So I recommend Al Jazeera. They have Al Jazeera English. And then we have, I guess in the West, it'd be Democracy Now! Is the only one I really see accurately reporting on, for example, the hostage exchanges that we witnessed at the beginning of this ceasefire. How undemocratic is it to witness money being sent over to a foreign country, prioritizing that country's rights over our own free speech rights, spending money that could be is desperately needed here for our needs on the ground with our homeless, our healthcare, our students, everything.
I spoke with Michael Huntington of Mid-Valley Healthcare Advocates and Healthcare for All Oregon, who told me that according to recent polls by the Elway Institute in Seattle, Oregonians are in favor of universal healthcare.
Universal healthcare came up as one of the solutions that actually gained 75% approval, the concept, universal healthcare, everybody in, nobody out. And this was regardless of congressional district, even east of the Cascades. Oregon is actually planning to have a universal healthcare system. There's a governance board that's working on it, chosen by the governor, approved by the Senate. They've been working on it for a year. Their job is to produce the financing, the taxation needed, and what kind of services and who would be eligible. That's a big job. They have to report that to the legislature in 2026.
I mentioned to Michael at this point that certain lobby groups and hospital association interests could put some big dollars behind negative ads, and that it would be important to spread the word well in advance of any legislative decisions.
We want to make sure they know about it and that they also participate with the governance board in creating this new plan. It's not going to be any good for some people in an office to say, this is what we think Oregon should have, and then go sell it. It's going to have to be town halls. What do you think you should have in your health care program? How are you willing to pay for it?
He indicated that reaching conservative voters on their own platforms may be the way to go, like conservative talk show host Lars Larson.
I think he's more likely to actually hear somebody and ask a question, and he's so persuasive and so authoritative. You just want to believe him. But he did listen to one of my calls, and he had a cordial back and forth about universal health care. We need to speak with people who are doubting or basically all conservative, find out what their fears are.
Indivisible of Benton County had one of the larger booths. The organization started in 2016 as a direct result of the first Trump administration, with a promise to combat everything he stood for. I interviewed Maria, hoping there was more to the platform than just opposing Trump.
It was founded by a couple of former Congress staff. Basically, they put together a Google document, went viral, and it became known as the Indivisible Guide to Resistance. And now it's just buffed up Indivisible Guide to Stronger Resistance. And we have chapters in all 50 states and several different counties in each state.
Are you attempting to reach moderate Republicans or conservatives or anything like that? Or is it more about just leveraging the base?
Right at this moment, the priority is levering the base. Indivisible is open to, would like to hear the other side. It's quite difficult to understand that people moderate would be still supporting a Nazi government. But we are happy to hear from people who disagree with us.
In full transparency, Indivisible may not be the group you want to reference when trying to communicate with conservative-minded folks, as it has been funded heavily by the Open Society Action Fund, a George Soros-backed political action committee, and thereby can be easily written off by diehard conservatives based on that fact alone. They also included NATO in their hands-off list, drawing criticism from the left as furthering the agenda of war profiteers. So while I support the overall platform, there's still a bent towards Western exceptionalism. Plus, I'm of the opinion that billionaire philanthropy projects like this are in direct opposition to the kind of bottom-up labor movement that could engage folks across the political spectrum. My final interviewee was wearing a sign around her neck that said, "I'm here for this conversation." While I was not intending to interview individual crowd participants, Zena's sign was provocative, and she was willing to speak candidly about what she witnesses at events like this.
I grew up here, and I love this place, and also I'm a black, disabled, queer woman, and I was raised by white people here. And a lot of people aren't coming out today. People of color are just not coming out, but for me, it's about the intersectionality.
I know there are so many more black and brown people here in town than we see.
I'm one of 39 people. So if you consider that, in this town, is that really that many? So no, it's like you have to acknowledge that we want more diversity, but we just need to be inclusive, like, to make that happen. And so I'm here because of that. Like, I want to see more of that, you know?
It can be a tough subject to broach, this notion that while Corvallis claims to value diversity, many black people feel uncomfortable here. I've heard several reasons articulated for why this is, and it's a topic that's worthy of its own segment, but kind of summed up in the book Contempt and Pity by Daryl Michael Scott, which points out that while conservative white Americans may hold black people in contempt for things like DEI hires or the perception they are losing the culture war, white liberals tend to use racialized pity, framing black people as perpetual victims in a system they can't possibly thrive in. Though arguably the latter yields more progressive legislation and hand-ups, as opposed to handouts, both of these worldviews can be psychologically damaging.
I came to the People's March here and just being like, oh, we're having people speak. Then people were like, sweetie, come up, honey. And I was like, come on, y'all. Like, we shelter white people, and we also don't want to feel that awkwardness because we have empathy. It's hard. If you want to understand more of the black experience, read the book, The Miseducation of the Negro. I know that's a hard word for some of y'all to hear, but read Parable of the Sower by Octavia E. Butler. Local news organizations are good to watch, of course, you know. OPB and NPR and any, you know, local stations. We look so globally and everything is so fast with information that we don't even realize what's happening locally that matters. And so I think we need to solve locally and solve bigger global issues.
And I would just add to that, think critically as you do so. Blatant falsehoods like the ones propagated by our current administration are easy to call out. The half-truths and lies by omission, much less so. In addition to the independent news sources mentioned throughout this piece, I would add Tangle News, 1440, and Braver Angels. Feel free to write in to ash@korcfm.com with your personal recommendations for credible news sources. And thanks in advance for putting KORC News and Civics Hour on that list.
This is Wendy Byrne with a list of Corvallis City meetings for the week starting Sunday, April 20th. There will be a City Council executive session on Monday, April 21st at 5:30 p.m. The public is not allowed to attend executive sessions of the City Council. The Council will meet in executive session to conduct deliberations with persons designated by the governing body to carry on labor negotiations. Executive sessions take place in Council chambers, which are located on the second floor of the downtown fire station at 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard in Corvallis. The City Council will hold their second business meeting of April on Monday, April 21st, starting at 6 p.m. Everyone is welcome and encouraged to attend City Council meetings. This meeting will take place both in person and virtually. See the published agenda for meeting details and participation instructions on the city website, corvallisoregon.gov. The meeting takes place in Council chambers located on the second floor of the downtown Corvallis Fire Station at 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard in Corvallis. The Corvallis Climate Action Advisory Board will meet on Tuesday, April 22nd at 4:30 p.m. The Climate Action Advisory Board meetings are held virtually and in person. To attend in person, come to the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, located at 500 Southwest Madison Avenue in downtown Corvallis. To see meeting materials and register to view the meeting virtually, visit the city website at corvallisoregon.gov. The Corvallis Forest Operational Advisory Committee meets on Wednesday, April 23rd at 5 p.m. The committee meets both in person and virtually. This meeting is open to the community and occurs at Madison Avenue Meeting Room at 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. To see meeting materials and register for the virtual attendance, go to corvallisoregon.gov. The Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force meeting for this week has been canceled. The Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force meeting for this week has been canceled. The Corvallis City Council work session will occur on Thursday, April 24th at 4 p.m. Everyone is welcome and encouraged to attend City Council work sessions. Work sessions are held in person and virtually. See the published agenda for work session details and participation instructions at corvallisoregon.gov. The meeting takes place in the Madison Avenue Meeting Room at 500 Southwest Madison Avenue in downtown Corvallis. Thank you for listening to KORC's News, Music, and Civics here at 105.9 FM and streaming at korcfm.com.
The following is a selection of headlines from last week on the program Democracy Now! More about the show, including recordings of full episodes, can be found at democracynow.org.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Yemen, Houthi-run media reports U.S. airstrikes targeting the Ras Issa oil port have killed at least 58 people. Over 125 others were wounded. The U.S. has been systematically attacking Yemen over the past month after Houthi fighters vowed to continue targeting Red Sea ships tied to Israel's war on Gaza. U.S. airstrikes on Yemen have killed over 180 people since mid-March, including many women and children. Israel's bombardment of Gaza continues, claiming at least another 34 victims today, including 10 members of the same family that were killed in a strike on a home in Khan Yunis earlier today. Meanwhile, one of the victims of an Israeli airstrike on Wednesday was revealed to be the young Palestinian photojournalist Fatima Hassona. She was killed along with 10 members of her family in Gaza City. She's the subject of a new documentary that was just accepted at the Cannes Film Festival. Hamas is calling for comprehensive ceasefire negotiations to definitively end the war on Gaza, including a full captive swap, as it rejected an Israeli interim proposal.
Netanyahu and his government use partial agreements as a cover for their political agenda, which is based on continuing the war of extermination and starvation. Even if the price is sacrificing all his hostages, we will not be part of passing this policy.
In legal news, the International Criminal Courts initiated proceedings against Hungary after the government of Prime Minister Viktor Orban failed to execute an arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he visited Hungary earlier this month. Just ahead of the visit, Orban announced he's withdrawing from the ICC. Netanyahu is wanted for war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen confirmed Thursday night he met with Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the Maryland father who the Trump administration says they forcibly transferred to an El Salvador mega prison last month by administrative error. Van Hollen shared a photo of the two seated together at a table in what appears to be a hotel restaurant. Senator Van Hollen traveled to El Salvador Wednesday in a push for Abrego Garcia's release, but had initially been barred from having any contact with him. Abrego Garcia's wife, Jennifer, celebrated the meeting, saying in a statement, "My children and my prayers have been answered," unquote. Meanwhile, in response to the senator's visit, Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele said on social media, quote, "Now that he's been confirmed healthy, he gets the honor of staying in El Salvador's custody." Bukele also wrote, quote, "Kilmer Abrego Garcia miraculously risen from the death camps and torture, now sipping margaritas with Senator Van Hollen in the tropical paradise of El Salvador," unquote. Abrego Garcia lived in Maryland for almost 15 years after fleeing gang violence in El Salvador and is a sheet metal worker. This comes at a federal appeals court ruled the Trump administration must comply with a judge's order for government officials to be deposed over Kilmer Abrego Garcia's case. That judge, Paula Zinnes, is weighing contempt proceedings against Trump officials. In the unanimous ruling Thursday, Fourth Circuit Court Judge Harvey Wilkinson, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan, wrote the Trump administration's acts are shocking, writing, quote, "The government is asserting a right to stash away residents of this country in foreign prisons without the semblance of due process that is the foundation of our constitutional order," unquote. This all comes as ACLU immigration attorney Lee Gelernt has confirmed that a group of Venezuelan immigrants currently jailed at the Bluebonnet ICE jail in Texas were told they are at risk of also being expelled from the United States under the controversial Alien Enemies Act of 1798, despite the ongoing legal challenges against its use. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear oral arguments over President Trump's executive order attempting to end birthright citizenship, as the measure remains on hold. The hearing is scheduled for May 15th, with a decision likely to be issued this summer. Several federal lower court judges have blocked the order, saying it violates the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment. Trump signed the executive order on his first day back in office. In other immigration news, Reuters is reporting Secretary of State Marco Rubio is ordering officials to review the social media accounts of visa applicants who visited the Gaza Strip any time in the past 18 years, including for work with aid organizations. A U.S.-born citizen who was arrested in Florida, accused of being undocumented and entering the state unlawfully, has been released after spending the night in jail on a 48-hour hold requested by ICE. Juan Carlos Lopez Gomez is from Georgia and was driving across state lines to his construction job in Tallahassee when he was pulled over, then taken into custody. He remained jailed despite presenting a copy of his birth certificate and Social Security card brought to court by his mother. Lopez Gomez was arrested and charged under a contested anti-immigration law known as SB 4C, signed by Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis 2 months ago, despite a federal court order temporarily blocking the measure from being enforced. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has signed a $30 million deal with the controversial surveillance tech giant Palantir, which will be used to help track and deport immigrants, including people who might have overstayed their visas. A database would also track cases of self-deportation and share data with Customs and Border Protection. The outlet 404 Media reports Palantir, which was founded by Elon Musk ally and billionaire Trump supporter Peter Thiel, has been working in recent weeks to increase ICE's capacity to monitor immigrants with final deportation orders. The new agreement is an extension of a contract with Palantir first signed by the Biden administration. Here in New York City, members of Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, their allies and elected leaders, gathered Thursday for the group's annual Seder in the streets on the sixth night of Passover. The protest took place under the banner of No Fascists, No Pharaohs. New York City mayoral candidate Zohran Mamdani, who's been endorsed by Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, spoke at the event.
And we know that in this moment in this city, when one in four New Yorkers is living in poverty, when 500,000 children go to sleep hungry every night, when more than 90% of New Yorkers agree that affordability is a serious issue, that this freedom is not just the right to live with our families in homes, but to be able to afford that home, to afford that dinner that we can share together as we break that bread.
Meanwhile, in Boston, 400 Jewish residents and others joined rabbis and community leaders to call for the release of the abducted Tufts graduate student, Ramesa Ozturk. The Passover rally was organized by the progressive Jewish group, If Not Now. On Wednesday, an immigration judge denied bond for Ozturk, declaring her to be a potential so-called danger to the community. Ramesa Ozturk is from Turkey. She was arrested in the streets of Somerville by masked agents for co-authoring a student op-ed on Tufts' response to Gaza solidarity protests on campus. The Trump administration is threatening to bar Harvard from enrolling international students unless university officials hand over the records of its current international students. This comes after Harvard openly rejected Trump's earlier ultimatum to the school, asserting its independence and constitutional rights. Meanwhile, House Republicans launched a civil rights probe into Harvard over its policy on trans athletes and diversity, equity and inclusion, DEI, which defy Trump's orders. On Thursday, protests took place on college campuses across the United States condemning the White House's attack on education and students. This is a student at the University of California, Berkeley.
I think that we have something that we're fighting for that is a little bit different than what we've been fighting for in the past, and that is our very right to keep fighting and our right to resist and our right to speak and learn and teach, even if it disagrees with the current political regime. And I think this is the fight to win all fights and that we need to show up and in a way that is more powerful and more abundant than in the past.
A federal judge ruled Google has run illegal monopolies on two markets for web advertising technology. It's the second antitrust ruling against Google in the past year. In 2023, a federal jury also concluded Google's proprietary app store is an unlawful monopoly. But the judge Thursday struck down one of the Justice Department's arguments against Google, making it unclear whether or when Google will be forced to sell off part of its online ad business. Consumer advocates welcomed yesterday's news with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren declaring, quote, Google is an illegal monopolist and it's time to break up this tech giant, Senator Warren said. President Trump threatened to fire Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell after Powell opted not to cut interest rates and warned Trump's tariffs are highly likely to raise inflation and slow growth. Trump made the comments renewing an ongoing dispute in his first term, despite the Fed's independence being protected by law.
Oh, he'll leave. If I ask him to, he'll be out of there. But I don't think he's doing the job. He's too late, always too late, a little slow, and I'm not happy with him. I let him know it, and if I want him out, he'll be out of there real fast, believe me.
The Supreme Court is currently reviewing a case involving two labor officials whom Trump fired, but were later reinstated after judges determined the president does not have the authority to remove them. An outcome favorable to Trump in that case could pave the way for him to also fire Jerome Powell. The Trump administration is seeking to redefine the meaning of harm under the Endangered Species Act in a move which environmentalists warn would threaten the survival of hundreds of plant and animal species. The proposed rule would allow industry to degrade or destroy habitats of endangered species, including panthers, sea turtles, bald eagles, spotted owls, gray wolves, and humpback whales. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the United States will determine in the coming days whether ending Russia's war on Ukraine is doable and may soon withdraw U.S. involvement.
We need to figure out here now within a matter of days whether this is doable in the short term, because if it's not, then I think we're just going to move on from our perspective.
The comments reflect the tensions between Washington and Kyiv and the growing wedge between Trump and its European counterparts as they try to compensate for the change in U.S. involvement in the Ukraine war under Trump. Meanwhile, Trump said on Thursday his administration would sign a deal with Kyiv in 1 week, exchanging security for access to Ukraine's rare earth minerals. The details of the deal are said to still be under negotiation. Inside Ukraine, Russian air attacks earlier today killed one person in Sumy and another in Kharkiv. The heavy bombardment in a residential area of Kharkiv wounded dozens of others, including children. In Florida, a 20-year-old son of a sheriff's deputy killed two people and injured at least six others when he opened fire Thursday on the Florida State University campus. Phoenix Ickner used a gun that was the former service weapon of Leon County Sheriff's Deputy Jessica Ickner, his mother. The suspect was also a member of the Sheriff's Youth Advisory Council. A motive has yet to be disclosed. And here in New York, a federal grand jury indicted Luigi Mangione, charging him with stalking and murder through the use of a firearm in the December shooting death of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. The murder charge holds a possible death penalty sentence if convicted. Mangione's lawyer accused Attorney General Pam Bondi of prejudicing the grand jury when she signaled recently she would seek the death penalty for Mangione. His defense said, quote, the stakes could not be higher. The United States government intends to kill Mr. Mangione as a political stunt, unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
And that was a selection of headlines from Democracy Now! More information about the program, including full episodes, can be found at democracynow.com. You're listening to KORC.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics, heard every Sunday from 1 to 2 p.m., repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KORC. This is Dan Kroll, and I am in the Southtown studio, joined today by Anna Cassilly. Anna has a master's in psychology. She has been doing 30-plus years of classes, much like a class that she is offering that starts April 24th, this coming Thursday, Communicate for a Change. Thanks for joining us in the studio today.
So good to be here. Thank you for having me.
We have spoken in the past about this very course that you were offering at the Friends Meeting House there at 3311 Northwest Polk Avenue, Communicate for a Change. Give us a little overview about what this class is.
Yeah, this is an opportunity for people to come together and look at how they're communicating, what's helpful about it, and what changes they might want to make. In particular, we're looking at how to express yourself in a way that's clear and compassionate, and how to listen to hear what the needs are for another person. So you're expressing your needs clearly and hearing the needs of another person so you can work together for solutions that meet both persons' needs.
It would seem in the modern world, when a lot of us are sitting behind a computer screen, we've kind of lost that ability to really make those compromises and even recognize those social cues.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the time we're not even aware of what we need, and a lot of the time the other person isn't aware of what they need. And by need, I'm talking about those universal needs, needs for support, for care, for understanding. And instead, we end up making demands, saying this is what it has to be, or the other person saying, I won't do that, rather than going deeper into why am I saying this is what I'm wanting and why is that person saying what they're wanting, to sort of uncover those deeper needs. Because whereas there's generally just one way to meet a demand, there's multiple ways to meet needs. So if we can move beyond the demands, and often accompanied by judgments and accusations, to hearing what the underlying needs are, then we open up possibilities for resolution.
And whether someone is in a relationship, raising children, dealing with coworkers, It would seem that this class offers communication tools for a number of us.
Yes, it's really true. The basic principles are across the board, whether you're talking to your two-year-old or your partner or at a workplace. Learning these basic skills are very helpful to navigate many different types of problems.
The classes start this coming Thursday. They will be held at the Corvallis Friends Meeting House. That's at 3311 Northwest Polk Avenue. Can you talk about the cost of these classes?
Yes. Now, this class is being offered as a benefit for the Corvallis Sustainability Coalition. And there's a sliding scale of $60 to $120. And I do offer work exchange and scholarships as needed. So someone would just get in touch with me for those options. Otherwise, they just go to my website, www.growingpeace.net, and you can get more information there about the class and can also register there.
Why don't you lay out an example of some of the exercises that you would cover in a given class? Maybe, what would people learn on the first night of these classes?
Yeah, the first night I go over an overview of the process developed by Dr. Marshall Rosenberg of nonviolent communication. And this is a basic methodology where we learn to express ourselves in four parts. We express what we're seeing or hearing. What would you actually capture on a recorder, videotape, rather than often what we express to someone is our interpretation of their actions. And this creates a lot of discrepancy. So first we want to say what we saw that happened, and then when that happened, what feelings came up. So observations, feelings, and then what was the need that was met or not met that resulted in those feelings. And then the last part is, and what do we need to ask of someone to meet our needs. So observations, feelings, needs, and requests is kind of the basic methodology we work with, although we go into many other aspects beyond that basic starting point.
For those who may not be familiar with nonviolent communication, why don't we play out a scenario where maybe let's like a husband and wife, let's say that the wife always has a hard time reminding the husband in a gentle way about, you know, picking up his clothes or something, as opposed to giving a command such as pick up your clothes or you forgot again to pick up your clothes. If someone actively employs nonviolent communication, how would they maybe reframe that kind of a request?
Okay. Well, we first start with sort of a formulaic way of learning. It's not necessarily what you would say in that moment, but just in terms of the model I just described, you might say, honey, I notice that there's an awful lot of clothes on the floor. And when I see that, I guess I just feel kind of anxious and unsettled because I so value order. And I'm just wondering what comes up for you when you hear me say this, because I would really love to have more order in the bedroom. I'm wondering how you feel about that. Okay, so you're just opening the conversation rather than saying, I can't believe you're leaving your stuff all over the floor again. I've asked you 10,000 times. Or then you begin to explore with the other person the needs that it's meeting for them and why it is that they're leaving the clothes on the floor and how they feel about it. So it's a conversation. You're not just making demands, because demands get met with resistance. So it's really about relationships. It's about understanding what's the needs of the other person and what are my needs, being able to express that in a way that's not judging, criticizing, or blaming. Because one of my favorite quotes from Marshall is that judgment, criticism, and blame are tragic expressions of unmet needs. Tragic because the way we're least likely to get those needs met. So what we want to do is uncover those needs so that we can help them meet their needs and express our needs in a way that doesn't provoke the other person and cause more conflict.
We are speaking with Anna Cassily. She has her master's in psychology from Sonoma State University in California and has been doing classes related to communication. She's offering Communicate for a Change. The class starts Thursday, this coming Thursday, April 24th, and goes through June 5th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Corvallis Friends Meeting House. located at 3311 Northwest Polk Avenue. And if listeners wanted to reach out to you to learn more about the class, maybe get a scholarship, it's a sliding scale of $60 to $120, and funds do benefit the Corvallis Sustainability Coalition. How might they get in touch with you?
Yes, they can either email me at anna@growingpeace.net. They can call me 541-301-7993 or go to my website for more information, www.growingpeace.net.
How would you sum up your goal with these classes? What do you really hope for any individual who takes these classes?
Well, one of the things Marshall often said is to make life more wonderful. I think that really kind of sums it up, to improve relationships, to have greater ease, to get beyond our fear of conflict, to see it as an opportunity to learn, to grow, and to just have better connections and have more ease at work and in the family and enjoy ourselves with one another rather than having so much time spent embroiled in conflict and inability to really express what we're needing and wanting.
Well, I'd like to thank you for coming to the Southtown studio and telling us about this class.
Well, thanks for having me, Dan. I sure appreciate it.
That's Anna Cassley, and she will be presenting Communicate for a Change starting this Thursday. They'll be meeting at the Corvallis Friends Meeting House 6 to 8 p.m. through June 5th. For more information, growingpeace.net. That's growingpeace.net. This is KORC News, Music, and Civics.